Every year on the second Sunday of May, Mother's Day is celebrated. I imagine more flowers and plants and other gifts are purchased on this day than probably any other than Christmas. And though it shouldn't be reserved for just one day, we use this holiday to express our appreciation and our love for our mothers. After all, where would we be without our moms? Literally, we would not be here at all. Now, often giving birth is called the miracle of life. And while that's true, there are certain births that I might say are more miraculous than others. And we read of many in the scriptures. You see, in the Bible, motherhood was not automatic. As natural as it is, it doesn't always happen. And in the ancient world, where giving birth to children was the extreme honor for women at that time, barrenness was considered a curse. I mean, if God blesses you by giving children, what does that mean if you don't have any? It must mean God's unhappy with you or you've done something wrong. Now, we know that's not true. The book of Job taught us that. But it was still considered a disgrace, a dishonor. And there are several instances in the Bible where God had to supernaturally intervene to enable a woman to bear a child. You see it with Sarah. You see it with Rachel. You see it with Samson's mother. We're not given her name. And Hannah, the mother of Samuel. And she is our focus for our message this morning. Now, each one of these stand as a witness to the power of God. But the birth of Samuel also is a testimony of the faith and the faithfulness of his mother, Hannah. Throughout the first two chapters of 1 Samuel, you see the faith and the faithfulness of Hannah that shines forth as an example for all mothers, indeed for all people. Out of the materialism and the spiritual anarchy of the time of the judges, her testimony is really a shining light in the darkness. And this morning I want to look at how Hannah was faithful in prayer. She was faithful to her promise, and she was faithful in her praise. Let's begin with seeing Hannah as faithful in her prayer. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 1. We're introduced to her family in the first 8 verses. Now there was a certain man from Ramathaim, a Zuphite from the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Jehoiam, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. He had 2 wives. One was called Hannah, and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. Year after year, this man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the 2 sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her, and the Lord had closed her womb. And because the Lord had closed her womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her until she wept and would not eat. Elkanah, her husband, would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why are you downhearted? Why won't you eat? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons?" Here we're introduced to a family that had an unusual situation. On the one hand, Hannah seems to be happily married to her husband Elkanah. Elkanah is called here an Ephraimite, but that's because of where he lived. We see in the Chronicles that he was actually a Levite. The Levites did not have territory of their own. They were spread out throughout the other tribes. And Elkanah was from a Levite family. And he seems to have been a godly man, Again, at a time where the nation is at a spiritual low, he regularly goes and worships God at the tabernacle that was set up in Shiloh. We're told here this is a regular practice that he had. Now, he has two wives. I know that is not God's ideal. It was permitted in that ancient culture. And my guess is that Elkanah married Hannah initially. They were very much in love. They had a good relationship, but Hannah was unable to bear children. Now understand, in the ancient world, that was grounds for divorce. Elkanah could have legally divorced Hannah because she could not bear children and married someone who could. But he did not do that. Instead, he married another woman, Peninnah, who was able to bear children and never let Hannah forget that fact. Every chance she got, she needled Hannah. And you see something very reminiscent of what happened with Jacob's sister wives, Leah and Rachel. You might remember that Jacob was in love with Rachel and got tricked into marrying Leah first, and then eventually married Rachel as well. And these two sisters did not get along. It was very obvious that Jacob favored Rachel, but Rachel was not able to bear children. And Leah was. And Leah rubbed it in every chance she got. Her firstborn son was named Reuben. We think, that's a good Jewish name. Pretty good sandwich, too. But in the Hebrew, Reuben means, look, a son. So every time Leah called her boy, she was rubbing it into Rachel. Hey, look, a son that you don't have. And that was the idea here. Peninnah kept harassing Hannah because she's jealous. She's jealous of the relationship that she has with her husband, but she's got children, and Hannah doesn't. And she just rubs that in every chance she gets. And we see that it really was a thorn in the side for Hannah. In that day, the stigma of childlessness was one of the worst afflictions a woman could bear. So it wasn't just this outward provoking, but inwardly she felt empty. There was a hole in her soul, and she felt it very keenly. So what did she do? Did she strike back at Peninnah? Did she whine and complain to her husband? No, we don't see any of that at all. In fact, Hannah's name in the original language means a woman of grace, and she really manifests that in how she deals with those around her. Instead, she goes to the Lord. So picking up the account in verse 9, once, when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on a chair by the doorpost at the Lord's temple. In bitterness of soul, Hannah wept much and prayed to the Lord. And she made a vow, saying, O Lord Almighty, if you would only look upon your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head. As she kept praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk, and said to her, how long will you keep getting drunk? Get rid of your wine. Oh, not so, my lord, Hannah replied. I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I've not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief. Then Eli answered, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him. She said, may your servant find favor in your eyes. Then she went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. You know, on one hand, this scene is comically tragic. Here comes a woman to the house of God to pray, and none other than the high priest accuses her of being drunk. I think that probably shows a little bit of the times where Eli would imagine that, because there are probably a lot of people that did come to the tabernacle being drunk. But instead of pouring too many drinks for herself, Hannah was pouring out her heart and her soul to the Lord. It's a very vivid phrase that portrays fervent prayer. And not just the kind of passing prayer that you pray and go on. This is deep in her heart. What makes this passage even more ironic is that Eli might consider her a wicked woman. In some of your Bibles, that's translated a daughter of Belial. Belial is another name for the devil. I mean, that's pretty strong. And she says, don't think of me in those terms. But in the very next chapter, Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, who were the priests, are called sons of Belial. He doesn't recognize it in his own sons who really are, but he thinks she is and she's not. So there's some kind of tragically comic elements in this story. To Eli's credit, though, once Hannah explains, he does offer her a blessing. But I want you to notice the prayer. Hannah gives us a great example of her faithfulness in her prayer. It was born out of sorrow and suffering, but despite her feelings, she goes to the Lord. She brings all of that bitterness, all of that frustration, all of that desire to pop Penina in the nose, she brings it to God. Instead of acting out on that, she brings it to the Lord, and that's what we're called to do. That's one of the great things about the Psalms. I know some people get all bent out of shape when they read some of the Psalms, and they're like, God, go get those people. They're giving me a hard time, and I want to see them paid back. That's not very Christian. Sure it is, because they're not out punching them in the nose. To use an old phrase I heard years ago, tell God on them. People are giving you a hard time. Take them to the Lord. Don't take it in your own hands. So understand that, you know, Hannah is bringing all of this stuff to the Lord because he's really the only one who can handle it. And that's a step of faith on her part. I think that her prayer here reveals an intimate relationship with God. It was very unusual for a woman to go by herself to the tabernacle. You keep reading long enough in 1 Samuel to see why. Eli's sons were known to take advantage of the women that came to worship. But nothing was going to stop her from pouring out her heart to the Lord. Now, verse 11 records a vow that she makes. If God would give her a son, he would give the son, she would give the son back to God. Now, you might think, well, yeah, he's a Levite. That's expected, right? Not entirely. Not the way she phrases this. She says, I will give my son to the Lord for his whole life. In the book of Numbers, chapter 8, verses 23 to 26, Levites were only expected to serve the Lord between ages of 25 and 50. Kind of makes some of you guys wish you were Levites, doesn't it? Retire at 50. But Hannah says he will be devoted to the Lord his whole life. And she also says that she vows his hair will never be cut. This is a sign of a Nazarite, different from Nazarene. Okay, two different words. Nazarite was a person in the Old Testament that made a vow to the Lord that for a certain period of time they would not cut their hair, they would not drink wine or actually touch anything that was made of grapes, have no contact with dead bodies. There were certain stipulations in this Nazarite vow. Usually, this was temporary. It might be for a matter of weeks or months, maybe even a year, probably at the most. But again, we see Hannah saying his whole life, he will be specially devoted to the Lord. The only other person we know of in Scripture that was a Nazarite for life was Samson. Although we know that eventually he broke every part of that Nazarite vow and ended up losing his strength. So here Hannah is dedicating her yet to be conceived child to the Lord for his whole life, which is very unusual in that time. Now, don't have the mistaken thought that Hannah is bargaining with God. She's not playing let's make a deal. If she does, she's pretty bad at it because she ends up losing the very thing she's asking for. She ends up giving the child back to God. It's not that she's going to hold on to him and enjoy him as a mother rightfully can. So she's not praying one of those foxhole prayers. You know what those are, right? You get in trouble. Oh, God, you get me out of here, and I promise I'll go to church every Sunday. I loved it several years ago. After the Chicago Cubs had won the World Series, somebody put a meme on Facebook that said, all Cub fans, church is at 10 o'clock Sunday morning. Yeah. So you know what those kinds of prayers are like. That's not what this is. We know that Hannah is genuinely making a vow to the Lord. And vows were taken very seriously in those days. And then the last way in which we see Hannah's faith in her praying is her reaction in verse 18. It says, she went away and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. Once she put it in God's hand, she was confident. She was strengthened. She was able to take those jabs from Peninnah without it letting it get to her. She was able to eat. It even changed the expression on her face. That's something a lot of Christians could use. Because frankly, a lot of us look like we've been baptized in persimmon juice, right? You know, it's kind of our normal look. I heard of a guy that sat down next to somebody on a plane. And I don't know what made the person ask this, but he says, are you a preacher? And the guy says, no, I just don't feel good right now. Why would you make that connection? We often give the impression that spirituality is measured by sourness. You know, it's the degree of droop in the edges of our mouth that shows how spiritual we are. Where do we get that? When Hannah put her need in the hands of the Lord, she walked away and it changed the expression on her face. Does worshiping the Lord do that for you? Does it not only make you feel good on the inside, but it brightens things on the outside too? I remember learning in Sunday school a little ditty. It goes, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands, right? Stomp your feet, you know, five other verses. Great for little kids that have energy to burn. But at the end of that chorus, it says, if you're happy and you know it, then your face should surely show it. Maybe we need to start singing that in our worship services again, because some of us need to have a facelift, and I'm not talking about plastic surgery. We need to show the joy of the Lord. And that's something that Hannah did. And it was a step of faith. Because again, the prayer hadn't been answered yet. But she's stepping out on faith that God is going to answer her prayer. Second, Hannah was faithful to her promise. We pick up the story in verse 19. Early the next morning, they arose and worshiped before the Lord, and then went back to their home at Ramah. Elkanah lay with Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So in the course of time, Hannah conceived and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, because I asked the Lord for him. I'm sure that after her prayer at the tabernacle, Hannah went back and told her husband about the vow. In fact, in the Hebrew law, the husband would affirm the vow that was made by a wife. They were together on this. And they went back home, and sure enough, Hannah was able to conceive. She gives birth to a son that she names Samuel, which literally means heard by God. And she said, "The Lord heard my prayer." Samuel was an answer to prayer, a real living answer to prayer. What would Hannah do once her prayer was answered? I mean, would she go the way of a lot of those foxhole prayers? You know, we promise God things and then it's gone. Well, let's take a look. Verse 21. When the man Elkanah went up with all his family to offer the annual sacrifice to the Lord and to fulfill his vow, Hannah did not go. Now here's a change. Hannah always went to worship. She said to her husband, "After the boy is weaned, I will take him and present him before the Lord, and he will live there always." So Hannah has every intention of fulfilling her vow. "Do what seems best to you," Elkanah, her husband, told her. Here's husband of the year right there. "Do what you think is best, smart man. Stay here until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord make good his word." Now, you might see that that could also be your word. The Lord can make good your word, fulfilling your vow. Elkanah is a good husband. He is supporting Hannah in her vow, in the fulfillment of it. He's right there with her. So the woman stayed home and nursed her son until she had weaned him. After he was weaned, she took the boy with her, young as he was, along with a 3-year-old bull, an ephah of flour and a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. When they had slaughtered the bull and they brought the boy to Eli, she said to him, "As surely as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here praying, who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. I prayed for this child, and the Lord has granted me what I've asked of him. So now I give him to the Lord. For his whole life he will be given over to the Lord." And he worshiped the Lord there. In those days, weaning a child usually happened at about the age of 3. So for those first 3 years, Hannah and Elkanah raised Samuel. And I'm sure that to the degree he was able to understand at that time, they raised him up in a godly way. They laid a foundation for him that would last his whole life. Don't underestimate the impact you have, moms and grandmothers, in those early years. Before they go off to school, trust me, if they're going off to school, they need that godly foundation. And going into this world, they're going to need a godly foundation. And it doesn't start when they're 10 or 12. It starts from day one. And they set that standard very early in his life that would last throughout his life. And that is so true. Even child psychologists are beginning to understand how important those early years are. Even before they can read and write, the lessons learned, the truth impressed upon their lives is something they're going to carry with them forever. We see that Hannah did indeed fulfill her promise. Moving ahead to chapter 2 and verse 11, "Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, but the boy ministered before the Lord under Eli the priest." God had given Hannah the desire of her heart, and she fulfilled her vow and said, "He is going to serve the Lord all the days of his life." Now, I'm sure that was painful. Moms, you remember the first time your kid got on the bus to go to school? Or maybe you took them to school and, you know, they're disappearing into that doorway without you. Think about bringing a 3-year-old somewhere and dropping them off, and you might see them a couple times a year. That's a big sacrifice. John White writes in his book, Parents in Pain, "I sometimes wonder at the trust of Hannah as she left her tiny Samuel in charge of old Eli at Shiloh. She had relinquished much, her right to possess, to enjoy, to be proud in the face of her rival, Peninnah, to control Samuel's development, to be repaid for all her tears. She did not know that her son would change the destiny of Israel, towering above the nation's history as the founder of 2 dynasties of kings, setting the moral tone for the nation for generations to come. All she did was fulfill her promise. She was faithful to her vow. She knew where her commitment needed to be, and her ability to release her child is a reminder to all Christian parents. You see, the first priority parents have with their children is to raise them to know the Lord. But the second priority is to release them at the proper time back to the Lord. And I would suggest that's a harder step than the first. I mean, it's challenging to raise children to know the Lord, especially in this culture. But how much harder is it to release them? To let them go into the hands of God, to make their own way. That's hard to do. Some don't. And it's very tough down the line. It takes a lot of faith to let them go. It's risky. You know, it's risky when a ship leaves the harbor. But that's what a ship is made for. A ship that stays at harbor isn't much good for anything. It's risky when a plane lifts off the runway and goes into the air. But that's what an airplane is made to do. An airplane that sits on the runway isn't much good for anything. It's risky when you release your child to the Lord. It takes faith that God's going to take care of them. But that's why your child was born. It was not to be your child and live under your roof for their entire lives. They're to go out, leave father and mother, serve the Lord with their lives, in their way, in a way that you might not understand, you might not even agree with, but you trust that that's what the Lord has for them. It takes a tremendous amount of faith. It's not easy, but it is necessary. You see, what Hannah did in a literal way, every parent is called to do emotionally. Parents who refuse to give up their children to God may have very painful experiences when that time comes. Whether they get old enough and they leave home to make a life of their own, or if they're called home at an early age to eternity. If we do not give our children to God, boy, it's tough when He has to pry our fingers off, isn't it? That's a painful experience indeed. But Hannah was faithful to her promise. And then finally, Hannah was faithful in her praise. We see a second prayer of Hannah recorded in the second chapter of 1 Samuel as a scripture reading this morning. Notice in verse 1, "My heart rejoices in the Lord. In the Lord, my horn is lifted high." In those days, a horn was a symbol of strength. "My mouth boasts over my enemies, for I delight in your deliverance. There is no one holy like the Lord. There is no one beside you. There is no rock like our God." And then throughout the rest of her prayer, you'll notice a pattern. The Lord brings down, but He lifts up. The Lord brings down the proud, but He lifts up the humble. He brings down the wealthy, but He lifts up the poor. Throughout her whole prayer, she is acknowledging what God has done. God is the God of the underdog many times. And she is a living proof of that. And she is rejoicing, and she is giving all of the praise and the glory to God. She is faithful in her praise. This song has sometimes been termed the Magnificat of the Old Testament. That term may not be familiar to you, but the Magnificat is the song of Mary, recorded in Luke when she is told that she's going to bear the Messiah. And it has a lot of resemblances to Hannah's prayer. I'm not so sure that she may not have been thinking about Hannah's prayer when she spoke her own prayer. In very similar situation, here is someone who could not bear a child naturally, giving praise to God for the child that she is about to bear. Hannah gives us a very healthy example of prayer. It's good for us to begin our prayers with praise because it focuses on the glory of God. If we come to God in prayer with our needs first, they seem so huge, they seem overwhelming. But when we begin our prayers reminding ourselves of who God is, all of our problems seem to shrink into their proper perspective. We see that God is greater than any need we bring to Him. And we can have faith that He can answer that prayer. Nothing is impossible with God. And we remind ourselves of that when we begin focusing on who God is and what He can do. Then we bring our needs to Him. And Hannah was faithful in returning praise when God answered her prayer. Remember the 10 lepers that Jesus healed? How many came back? One. Typical men, right? Hannah praised God when God answered her prayer. And that is a great example for all of us. For this child, I prayed. You know, I've seen pictures and plaques and different things that often go in a nursery. Especially when parents have had trouble conceiving. And maybe it has been through much prayer that finally a child is born. For this child I prayed. Every time Hannah would say the name Samuel, she's reminded, the Lord heard my prayer. Here is an answer to prayer. And she was faithful in returning praise to God when He answered that prayer. You know, if we had more godly mothers like Hannah, more godly parents like Elkanah and Hannah, we might have more godly people like Samuel. We might have the answers to those earlier prayers. Lord, raise up leaders for our nation. If we want to see godly leaders in our nation, we need to see godly children in our churches. We need to see godly parents that are raising those children in spite of what our culture is telling us, in spite of the changing laws and the changing values and the changing morals. We need to stand for the truth, and it starts at home. Don't expect the school system to raise your children right. It's not going to happen. Don't expect Hollywood to raise your children right. It's not going to happen. Dare I say, don't expect the church to raise your children. Because while the church can be a facet, it starts at home. And we need to bring that responsibility back where it belongs. Christian education begins at home. And it starts from day one. Now, I know many of you, your children have grown and they're out of the home. You might have grandchildren. You might have great-grandchildren. You still have an opportunity to have an impact on that child. You pray for them. Be faithful in prayer. Be faithful in your promises. Be faithful in your praise. Who knows? We may be raising a Samuel and we don't even know it. Hannah was truly a mother of her word. May her tribe increase.